A while back, I was coming down from my office down to the kitchen, and unbeknown to me, one of my dear children had decided to hide behind a corner so that as I walked by, they jumped out, scaring the wits out of me, much to their joy and amusement, and not to mine. Now, there are other days when I see them hiding. I catch a glimpse of them getting into position, or I hear them as they wait. And on such days, I have a choice. I can either shout out, "You're busted," and ruin it for them, or I can play along and pretend they got me, or I can get them and make them jump. And I'll leave it to you which one of those options I choose. Seeing what is before me prepares me, it enables me to get ready, to respond in a certain way. And Daniel 8, this vision of rams and goats and horns, functions in much the same way. It's a vision that was primarily given to prepare God's people for what is coming and to live in this world now so that we're not surprised, we're not scared, and we don't give up. So firstly then, God's people prepared. God's people prepared. And I'll let you know right now up front, this first point is by far the longest point. So when we get to the end of it, and you hear me say second point, don't go, "Oh my." Go, "It's okay. We know it's not as long as the second and third, it's not as long as the first." Okay, so that's the warning. God's people prepared. So Daniel has this second vision. And in this vision, he's transported to the citadel of Susa, an influential city in the life of the Medes and the Persians. And as he stands beside the Ulay Canal, this magnificent human-made waterway, Daniel looks up and he sees a ram, verse 3. The ram has two horns and it charges with success in three directions, west, north, and south. Verse 4. And we're told at the end of verse 4, no animal could stand against it. It did as he pleased and became great. Then a second animal interrupts this vision of the ram, and it's a goat coming from the west, verse 5. And it has a single large horn. It has great speed, indicated by its racing across the landscape without touching the ground, verse 5. The goat attacks the ram furiously and succeeds in knocking off its horn. The goat utterly overwhelms the ram. Verse 8, the goat becomes very great. However, its greatness does not last forever. It is suddenly cut off at the height of its power. The prominent horn that the goat displayed is broken, and in its place grows four others, verse 8, spreading out in four directions. Then verse 9, out of one of the horns comes another horn. And all that has gone before, we discover, has kind of been a prelude to this horn. The vision primarily is all about this horn. And we already know the symbol of the horn points to a king or a kingdom. And so this small horn, this king, takes on large proportions as it grows in power to the south, the east, and towards the beautiful land, verse 9, beautiful land, which is Israel. But the growth of the horn reaches beyond human dimensions. It grows until it reaches the host of the heavens, verse 10, and enters into a conflict with this heavenly army. Strikingly, the text reports that the small horn, verse 10, achieves some measure of success against its rivals in the sky, throwing some of the starry host down to the earth and trampling on them. Then climatically, the horn challenges the prince of the host, God himself, verse 11. And the way the horn does this is by attacking the formal worship of Israel. It takes away the daily sacrifice, verse 12. And place of the sanctuary was taken low, desolated, we're told, verse 13. And verse 12, whether as a result of the people's own rebellion, possibly, particularly in light of Daniel's prayer, chapter 9, a great prayer of repentance, or more likely, whether as a result of the horn's rebellion, God's people, the host of the saints, verse 12, are given over to this horn. That is, they fall under his rule, as do the daily sacrifices. And we read the end of verse 12, the horn prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. At this point, then, Daniel hears, verse 13, a holy one, an angel, asking, how long will this continue? And the answer comes back, 2,300 days. Now, what does all this mean? Well, Daniel tells us, verse 15 and following. And the good news is, the scholars, the commentators, are all pretty unanimous on the interpretation. It's describing a period of history, approximately about 200-300 years after Daniel. So kind of around 200 BC up to 175 BC and before that, 300 to 175 BC, around that kind of time. And it's speaking of that period of history, particularly that we saw in chapter 7, when, remember, we had four beasts, and this vision is talking about what is going on in the time of the second beast and the third beast. And remember, the four beasts represented Babylon, second beast, Medes and Persians, third beast, the Greeks, the fourth beast, the Romans. And this vision is concerned with the period of the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks and what goes on from the Greek king. And it's told with remarkable accuracy. The history that this vision reveals is so remarkably accurate that many liberal scholars believe that Daniel was written as a book after all the events had happened, pretty much probably around the time of Jesus and before that, because of the accuracy of which he describes his events is such that it seems impossible for them to believe that a god or the god could have so foretold it. And so what is this period? What is the history? Well, verse 20, we're told the ram represents the king of Media and Persia. The goat, verse 21, represents the king of Greece. That would have been Alexander the Great. And he achieved an unprecedented domination from Italy to India in unbelievable time. Remember what the vision said, verse 5, that this goat would come and he would have speed, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. That's what Alexander the Great did. But Alexander the Great suddenly died, age 33. At the height of his power, verse 8, he's cut off. And the four horns that followed, we're told, verse 22, represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his nation, but will not have the same power. And after Alexander the Great's death, the world was carved up between Alexander's four powerful generals. Now, Alexander the Great was one of the greatest military strategists, one of the pivotal men in world history. And yet in Daniel 8, he's a mere footnote. He merits barely a mention. And the reason why is because God's concern here is not with history per se, although he's telling history with a remarkable accuracy and detail. But his focus is not on what is just happening in history. God's concern is for his people and what will happen to them. And so we're told, verse 23, in the latter part of their reign, that is of the four generals, when rebels had become completely wicked, a stern-faced or a fierce-looking king, a master of intrigue, will arise. He'll become very strong, but not by his own power. He will cause astounding devastation, will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy the mighty men and the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the prince or princes. And of course, now with the benefit of historical hindsight, we can clearly identify who this little despicable horn is that rises up from the four generals. Anyone have a guess at who it is? Okay, I'll say. That was no fun. It's a guy called Antiochus. Antiochus Epiphanes, the fourth. Antiochus, whose nickname Epiphanes means God made manifest, in the legends or in the truth of the history, his nickname gets turned to become the madman, a kind of a play on the word Epiphanes. But he was a king of one of the Seleucid empires, that is one of the four kingdoms that emerged from Alexander the Great's former territory. And initially, he was not first in line for the throne, but he seized it from his nephew through intrigue and then enlarged his kingdom through substantial military successes. Antiochus was a tyrant who tried to unify his kingdom by forcing all his subjects to adopt Greek culture and religious practices. He banned circumcision. He brought an end to the sacrifice at the temple in Jerusalem. He then deliberately defiled the temple by dedicating it to Zeus. He burnt pig's flesh on the altar. Now, of course, we're aware that for Jews, the pig was the animal not to touch or have anything to do with, and here he is, burning it on the very altar of the living God's temple. He places an object sacred to Zeus in the Holy of Holies, the place where only the high priest could enter once a year. He desolated the temple, just as the vision, verse 13, had foretold. Antiochus burnt copies of the scriptures. Do you remember verse 12? Truth thrown to the ground. He slaughtered somewhere up to 80,000 who remained true to their faith in God. He fits perfectly the description of a stern-faced king who was completely wicked, verse 23, who caused astounding devastation, verse 24, who destroyed mighty men and holy people. Daniel 8 recalls or foresees this period of history with remarkable accuracy. But Daniel 8 is doing more than just tell us of what's happening in the earthly realms. It's also peering behind the curtain, as it was. Yes, there is earthly battles between earthly kings who oppose God's people. But there's also a spiritual dimension, a spiritual battle going on. Remember verse 10. We're told that this horn would make himself as great as God. He would sweep stars from the sky. It's visionary language to describe what's happening, as it were, behind the scenes. That behind this horn, behind Antiochus, is powerful spiritual forces of darkness arrayed against our God. But our God knows it all. He foresees all that will take place, both in the spiritual realm, and in the earthly. Nothing is outside of his control and his knowledge. So you have to keep in mind as you read this that it's written 200-300 years before the events, and it transpires with remarkable accuracy. And it does so because God is in control and he's preparing his people. Now, why does he do that? Why does he give Daniel such a vision? Well, remember where Daniel is. He's in Babylon. He's aware that the 70 years of Israel's exile are coming closer to close. And you can imagine the expectations of God's people of returning back to their land, back to the beautiful land, back to Israel. And they're imagining, oh, it's going to prosper as it once had. They're looking ahead for a Messiah-like figure that Isaiah has kind of foretold and prophesied about. A Messiah who will come and rescue them and rule them and establish Israel as a mighty kingdom once more. They're looking back in the scripture and they're thinking of the David and Solomon times. They're thinking we'll go back to the land and things are going to be great and marvelous and wonderful. But imagine if they return with their expectations in place to discover actually that, well, the Medes and the Persians still ruled and ruled them. And then came Alexander the Great. And then worst of all, a little tyrant called Antiochus, who persecuted them, who desolated the temple. And you see, without knowing what was coming, God's people would have slipped into despair and fallen away. You only have to recall how Nehemiah or Ezra and Nehemiah speak of when they were building, rebuilding the temple. And we read in Ezra, the old men wept because they remember the glory of the previous temple. And this one that they were rebuilding, having come back from exile, was just not as good, as great. They wept. Imagine if you come back to the land with such high expectations to be faced with this. Calvin writes, for as nothing had been predicted, the pious would have glided gently downwards to despair in consequences of their heavy afflictions. And if this had not been predicted, they would have thought themselves deceived by the splendid promises concerning their return, and they would have fallen away. But God in his grace, God in his sovereignty, prepares his people for what will happen, such that they will not despair, such that they will not be deceived by the promises, but rather trust in his sovereign purposes, in his control. He forewarns them. And there's no kind of greater evidence that he's in control, that he's ruling and reigning, that his promises hold firm, than being able to reveal with startling accuracy what will take place. In other words, he's saying to his people, trust me. Trust me. You're going back. Things will be hard. Persecution will come. Tyrants will raise up. But trust me. I know it's going to happen, but my promises still hold true. Don't be scared. Don't give up. I'm on my throne. I'm working out my purposes for your good and my glory. Trust me. Trust me. Now, here's the thing. Daniel 8 is as much a vision for us today as it was for the people then. See, for Daniel 8... Sorry, I'm not being... Get the handouts. There we go. Little break. Daniel 8 is a pre-shadowing, a foretaste of the opposition of God's people living in the end days, in the times that we now live. I think that's why Daniel is told, have a look at verse 17, that the vision concerns the time of the ends, and yet then describes a very specific period of history. Because actually it's pre-shadowing what will happen in the last days. That the real events of history that happen in Israel's time and to God's people are just a foretaste of what will come. And so in turn it prepares us. See, Antiochus is a forerunner of what the New Testament calls the man of lawlessness or the Antichrist. And he's certainly a forerunner of what the Antichrist will be like. Turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And verse 4. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4. And we read of this man of lawlessness, which possibly is also the Antichrist, or he's certainly one of an Antichrist-like figure, one of the many that John speaks about. I'll see in a moment. But here we read 2 Thessalonians 2:4, the man of lawlessness. And as Paul describes him, listen to how his description matches that of Antiochus. So verse 4, we read, he will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. See, just as Antiochus had claimed to be as great as the prince of hosts, just as Antiochus had set himself up in God's temple, so does the man of lawlessness. And Paul, in writing 2 Thessalonians, is saying, hey, watch out for such a one. That such a day will come as part of the end days, the last days. And we're in the last days. The last days started when Christ was crucified and risen, and they end when Christ comes again. We're in the last days. And Paul's saying, watch out for such a one in such a day. There'll be one who will come and oppose with much hatred towards God and much hatred towards God's people. And of course, the Apostle John says a similar thing in 1 John 2:18. You might want to turn to that as well. And we read in 1 John 2:18. Dear children, this is the last hour. And as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come. This is how we know it is the last hour. In other words, these ones who will come will hate Jesus and will hate his people. And Jesus himself warns of such days in Matthew 24 that there'll be those who seek to deceive and there'll be persecution and there'll be opposition to the gospel and to him. And these things will intensify as the end gets nearer and these ones will come. And the warning is clear. Be prepared for such a days. Know they're coming. Be prepared for persecution and for suffering and for opposition, which will intensify the nearer we get to that time when Jesus comes. Be prepared. Trust me, says God. Trust me that when those days come, and it will be horrific for the people of God, trust me. Trust me that I'm working out my purposes. Trust me. Be prepared. Now, we don't know when the man of lawlessness or the Antichrist will appear. Many have guessed it. But a mark of being in the last days, full stop. The period that we're in is that of opposition and persecution, hatred of God and hatred of God's people. I mean, think of what Jesus himself warned his disciples in John 15. He warned them of persecution. He says, look, the world hates me, the world's going to hate you. And then strikingly, Jesus goes on to say immediately after that, in John 16, verse 1, all this I have told you so that you will not go astray. You will not fall away. In other words, you will not be deceived. You will not despise the promises. Look, Jesus is coming again. Jesus is ruling. But you're going to face persecution in these days. And Jesus has prepared us to live in these last days, just as God prepared Daniel and the people then. Jesus prepares his people. There will be opposition. There's going to be persecution. And there's going to be a time coming when those things will intensify. But trust me, I've told you all this, says Jesus. I've told you this so you're not surprised, so you're not scared, so you won't fall away. And yet, how is it that we're more often surprised when the world opposes us and persecutes us? That actually we become disheartened and we behave as if this, well, this just should not be, and we kind of despair at it. So there's outrage at the moment amongst believers in particular that Starbucks chose this year not to put Merry Christmas on their red cups. And there's outrage. Let's boycott Starbucks. And yet why does it surprise us? Why does it surprise us as we live increasingly in a secular age that increasingly opposes Jesus as in people? Of course they're not going to want to put Christmas on their cups. It speaks of Christ. They hate him. They hate us. And yet we are not just saddened by such events. We despair as if suddenly we think the whole world has gone completely mad. As if suddenly, oh my goodness me, what is going on? And we're outraged. And yet that's exactly what Jesus prepares his people for. Or we hear of just this last week in Belfast of a play where Jesus is represented as a transgender woman. And we're outraged. And we should be outraged. We should be saddened that they would want to portray our Lord and our Savior in this way. But we're outraged more in the fact that we're somehow surprised that this would happen. As if suddenly, oh my goodness me, the world is behaving in this way. We cannot believe it. And Jesus says, look, I prepared you for it. It's exactly what you should expect in these last days. And it's only going to get worse. But of course, the problem is that we've been deceived into thinking the world is somehow our friend. That the world is somehow on our side. But of course, the truth is, the world hates us just as it hated Jesus. The world crucified him. They desolated the temple. Now, of course, by common grace and God's kindness, of course, we'll have friendships with those who are of the world, that are not God's people. But the world, as that which is opposed to God, that is formed of those people who do not follow Christ, is ultimately against Jesus and is ultimately, in turn, his people. And Daniel 8:10 makes clear that this is also a spiritual battle that's raging behind the scenes. That as the world opposes us, Satan and his minions are also at work opposing. So let us not be surprised. Let's be saddened. Let us be outraged that they may malign our Christ, but let us not be surprised. Let us not be despair or disheartened. Because Daniel 8 makes it clear we're to be prepared and we're to live as those prepared. We're to live like a good scout or a girl guide. And we're to see the boys around the corner. And we know what's coming. So don't be scared. Don't give up. Trust him. Trust me, says Jesus. Keep running. God prepares his people. And then secondly, remember what I said. First point, very long. Second, third, not so long. God's people are prepared, but secondly, we discover God's people prevail. See, it's one thing knowing that the battle is coming, but it leads to the question, doesn't it, that we hear in 8 verse 13, how long will it take? How long, O Lord? In a similar way that the saints are under the altar in Revelation 6, crying out, how long, O sovereign Lord, before you judge the earth? How long, Lord, before you put things right? And so the Holy One in verse 13 asks the question, how long? And the answer comes back, 2,300 evenings and morning. Now, there's a huge debate over this number and how it fits. Is it talking about the number of sacrifices, so it's only actually 1,150 days? Or is it talking about the total number of days and 2,300? And either way, you can fit it with much of what Antiochus did. So whether it's starting with when he set up an altar to Zeus and then ends when, amazingly, Judas of the Maccabees cleanses and rededicates the temple, you get 1,150 days, give or take. Or if it's starting with when the high priest, when Antiochus killed the high priest of the time, Oriel, and then ends with the same period, Judas the Maccabee cleansing and rededicating the temple, you get 2,300 days. But actually, how it fits is not as important. It's more important is the fact there's a fixed time that the persecution will not endure forever. And more than that, verse 14, after it, the temple will be reconsecrated. In other words, things will be restored. God and his people will dwell together. God's people will be able to worship proper again. And then we read chapter 8, verse 25, Daniel, that this one, this horn who opposes God's people will be destroyed, but not by man's power, but by God himself. In other words, victory is assured for God's people. And of course, as we read this and apply this to our time, we know, look, persecution will end. There will come an end. God has a date for when his son will return, ending such days. And of course, at such a point, the temple will be reconsecrated fully. I mean, part of that's already happened. The temple was desolated when Jesus was crucified. He is the temple. And then when he raised 3 days later, the temple was reconsecrated. Remember what he said to the Pharisees? You kill me, but 3 days later, the temple will be destroyed, but 3 days later, I'll raise it again. But ultimately, that's fulfilled when Christ comes. And we read Revelation 22, there is no temple anymore because now God dwells with his people. And it's a beautiful picture because the temple is all about, isn't it, dwelling with God and his people. In other words, the time, the end will come, and God's people will enjoy and delight in being with God's people and with him. But more than that, victory is utterly assured. See, not because of us, not because of man, but because of Jesus, because of the cross. Paul writes, Colossians 2:15, that Jesus has disarmed the power and authorities. He made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. In other words, Jesus has defeated all who oppose him. The victory is utterly certain. The devil is defeated. And all who follow him, including the man of lawlessness and the Antichrist who are still to come. Yes, the devil still roams. He's a roaring lion, says Peter in 1 Peter 5. Yes, there is a spiritual battle. Yes, the kings in the earth will oppose God's people, but their defeat is assured. Victory is Christ's and his people's. You see, in effect, we live in the days like in between VE Day and V Day. The war was won on VE Day. There was no doubt the Allies had won. But it took a few more weeks before V-Day could happen. And in that time, there were skirmishes and battles, but victory was already assured. The war had been won. And similarly, because of the cross, victory is assured. But we're waiting for that final V-Day. And as we wait, there are battles to be had, and there'll be skirmishes to be fought, and some days it will seem as if the devil and the world is winning. But we look to the cross, and we see, no, the victory is utterly assured. And we look forward to that day with real hope and real certainty when we'll stand with Jesus and be with him forever. Victory is ours. God's people will prevail. And it's all very well known what will happen and that victory is assured and looking forward to that day. But how do you live in the meantime? Well, lastly, God's people push on. We push on. So you have a look at verse 27. We read, I, Daniel, was exhausted and lay ill for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled by the vision. It was beyond understanding. How do we live? We live as those who not understand everything. We don't understand everything. We know all we need to know. We know opposition will come, both earthly and spiritual. We know that Jesus has won the victory, but we don't know everything. There'll be things that happen that I don't quite understand or grasp why God has allowed, just as it was true for Daniel. But I know what I need to know. And yet, sadly, so many want to claim that they do know, that they know when Christ is going to return. A few years ago, October 2011, I was visiting my granddad in Vegas. And he took me to a local ice hockey game down at one of the local hotels. And at this game, they were celebrating that the world had not ended. For years before, a gentleman called Harold Camping, who sadly for years had faithfully taught the Bible, had begun to predict that the world would end. And he predicted that on the 21st of October 2011, Jesus would come. Now you have to understand, he'd previously claimed that would be true in May 1994, October 1994, and May 2011. So no one was really holding their breath. And so here I was in Vegas watching a hockey match where they're celebrating that the end of the world has not come. We don't know all the details about the end days. We don't know when the Antichrist or the man of lawlessness will come. We don't know the minutiae detail, as it were. We do know all we need to know. And we need to keep trusting in God's purposes, trusting his sovereign plans rather than speculating on what we do not know. And as we live in their times, we are to be saddened. Saddened by such horrific days and appalled by such events. Because we know that such days mean that Judgment Day is coming ever nearer. And that will mean many will be lost. And we're called to care passionately and deeply for our lost neighbours. To be personally devastated by the prospect that they may spend eternity in hell. Compassion for their souls demands nothing less from us. And the extent to which the lostness of the world, the truth of these teachings, touches our hearts is the extent to which we'll be motivated to bring our neighbours the good news of the gospel and go on bringing it to them, even when they don't want to hear it. You were to be those who are on the king's business. I just love that little line, verse 27. He gets up and he goes about the king's business. And I'm assuming by that he means literally he got on with his work as a civil servant of King Belshazzar, but he also got on serving his true King God. And is that not what we're called to do as we wait, as we endure, that we get on with the king's business? Wherever he's called us, in our work, in our homes, in our communities, on the ward, in the classroom, in the boardroom, in the factory, we serve the king. And what is his business? To make disciples. To share the good news of Jesus with others. That's the business he's left us with. And if I'm grasped, and if I've seen just what is to come and what is happening, and I have an understanding of that spiritual battle that has been engaged, And I can see that actually judgment is coming and will come, and I know that for certain. See, how that touches my heart will drive me in wanting to make disciples, in reaching the lost. And you know what else it'll do? It'll make me want to pray. I want to pray for the lost, and I want to pray for this world. And this is how we know. Here's a little test of whether you've kind of grasped, or whether you're really touched by the reality of what is to come, and that judgment day is coming, and that the victory is assured. Prayer meetings. That's the test, ultimately, of whether we've seen there's a spiritual battle, whether we're ultimately prepared or being prepared or getting prepared, is whether they're at prayer meetings. See, if I really believe that actually the world is lost without Christ, and that only the Spirit can do that work, then I'm going to be praying. Not just personally, but corporately. And yet often the truth is that prayer meetings come on a Tuesday evening once a month, and there are maybe the size of one community group and a bit more here present. And what does that say about us? See, if I've truly grasped what is to come, and I'm on the King's business, and I want to make disciples, then I'm going to be praying. I'm not going to be at home watching telly. I know that's not true for everyone, and others, well, there'll always be legitimate reasons. But it's worth asking yourself, are you prepared? Or are you more concerned with the business of this world than the King's business? God's people are prepared, God's people prevail, and God's people push on.